Good morning, good afternoon, wherever you are. This is Chris, and this is a recording of a coaching session done this week. And I thought it would be interesting for everybody to listen to, with permission of the person I was coaching, who will remain anonymous. Anyway, I hope you enjoy it. Bye for now. The first thing to realize is mental health is not an aspiration. Mental health is the default. The normal. We are all mentally healthy, and all mental ill health is caused by something going wrong. And the first thing, which means depression and chronic fatigue and ADD and bipolar, it's all caused by something not normal. And what happens over a period of time is we start to think that our mental illness is normal. And the first one we talk about is gratitude for the past. That is a really normal thing. And the Chinese said, if you wait long enough, if you're 80 or 90 years old, you'll eventually say, someone says to you, you know, what are you ungrateful for the past? And you go, I have no regrets. And everything happened, was meant to happen, and I'm happy that it did, and I'm blah, blah, blah. And so you'll eventually, as the Chinese say, time is the greatest healer, you'll eventually say, I'm grateful for the past. It's sort of sad that, you know, if we're 35 or 40, and we wait for another 45 years, thinking that we're normal by being grumpy about the past, until we finally go, oh, actually, my normal became my default, but my normal and my default wasn't healthy. It wasn't normal. It was just what I got used to thinking. I got used to thinking that there are things in the past that I should regret and should be grumpy about, and that if I'm not thankful for people, I'm actually doing myself a favor if I think like that. But actually that's And then that same person who's not thankful for the past, not thankful for other people in the past, not thankful for what's happened before, that same person has a mental health problems and blames the people that they're not thankful for, and says, I've got a mental health problem. But they haven't got a mental health problem. What they've got is a way of thinking that's become their default, that they think is what everyone else thinks, but it's not. So step one in mental health is to say, mental health is not an aspiration. I don't aspire to mental health. If I am mentally healthy, I'm already there. What I have to be aware of is the red flags of when I'm getting mentally unhealthy. So step one is gratitude for the past. Step two is presence. Gratitude, presence. Presence is not like Christmas presents. Presence means that if I am somewhere, my senses of my body, the six senses of my body, my taste, my touch, my sight, my hearing, my feeling, all the senses and my intuition, smell, all my senses arrive at one thing at the same time. So if I'm talking to you, opposite you in a live interview, I will, the smell of the room or the smell of your perfume or the smell of your breath or the smell of your fart or whatever it is, I will be aware of it. And then I'll be aware of what you're saying. Then I'll be aware of what you look like when you're saying it. And I'll be aware of how I feel about what you're saying. And I'll be aware, and I'll be seeing it, hearing it, tasting it, feeling it, everything. And absolute presence is what a performer, a Pink or somebody who's singing on stage, absolute presence means every sense of their body is arriving at one place at one time. You can get a person to do that by coming up behind them and banging really loud on the floor, and every sense in their body, their sight, seeing, taste, smell, touch, all is what's going on. You know, everything. But we can't go around banging tables behind people. What we do is we gain their interest. We gain people's excitement. We gain people's attention. When someone, we get someone's 100% attention, like I have with you right now, when you gain someone's full attention, all their senses are directed towards the same thing. So you might not be tasting over a camera, but taste is not somewhere else. It's not sucking on chocolate or tasting something. And even if you do have the taste of coffee in your mouth or something like that, you're not aware of it because that sense is aligned. So presence is the second step in mental health, is the ability to just be 100% where you are. And that's not an aspiration. That's not something you need to meditate for or go training in yoga for. That's automatic. I mean, seriously, if you eat a beautiful apple and you hear the crunch of the apple, you taste the apple, you can smell the gorgeous flavor of the apple, you can see that there's no worms in it, and actually you feel the apple in your hand. Man, there's no meditation deeper than that. And that's simply mental health. That is simply step two, that anybody who's in a mentally healthy, normal place, they will be present wherever they go, whatever they do. They're not just doing five things at once, thinking about one thing, driving the car, eating a banana and, looking out the window at a different direction. They're there. So when we lose presence, we start making accidents. We start losing, tripping over, and we start making mistakes, and we start beating ourselves up. We start being self-critical. We give ourselves the time to not like who we are because we're not present with who we are. It goes to the quote that says, if you're not perfect already, you never will be. And that's where what we've talked about before, someday I'll. It's just a great way where people say, someday I'll, which means I don't want to be present with who I am right now. I don't like it enough. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to walk in the present because I got no choice, otherwise I get run over. But I'm going to live in the future because someday I'll be better. But when they get to Someday Isle, which is an island in the Whit Sunday, you know that, and when they get there, they find there's a better island further down. And that pursuit is a mental health problem, and it leads to sickness because that individual is not here. They're not living. They're not alive. They're not enthusiastic. They're not... I would say the word is happy, but a better word that is just not enthusiastic. And they're not enthusiastic because they're spreading the Vegemite too thin all over the toast. It's just way distracted. And they're deferring. They're saying, I'm not perfect, but I will be if I do X, Y, Z. And therefore, you can't say what mental health is, because what you've got to be able to say is mental health is like fresh air. To one person living at the beach knows the taste of fresh air from a beach point of view, but if another person living in a forest, they're breathing a different air, and another person's living in the mountains, in the snow in the mountains, they're breathing a different air. It's a different air, different taste, different flavor. You can't say what mental health is. It's circumstantial. But what you know is that each of those people are breathing air. The air is clean. And each of those people, if we take the metaphor of air being mental health, each of that person is just taking for granted that the air that they're in is good. So the mind that they're in is good. So the mental health is just fresh air. It's not an aspiration. The third one, which is where most people stumble in mental health issues, is certainty. The human heart and all human beings' eyes are turned to the future. Everybody, every person on earth is turned to the future. So we be present. Once we're present in this moment, our focus becomes the future. What's going to happen? Am I safe? Do I have enough money? What will happen then? What will happen after that? And you can only have one feeling about the future other than certainty, and that is fear. When fear of the future comes, we get doubt. And doubt is, in a spiritual language or in self-help language, doubt is our greatest enemy. Doubt, on that one hand, feeds us and says, hey, it's time to revision, time to look at something, it's time to take a challenge. But doubt can't become the default. And you'd be really surprised how many people have doubt for a little period. They work in a job that gives them doubt. I don't know if you're going to have a job next month, so they get this doubt for a month that everything's going to be okay. But when everything is okay, they still keep the doubt. the problem goes away, but the mindset sticks. And this is the most difficult one. When somebody's brought up in a family where doubt is quite prevalent, they learn to live with doubt. And then when the doubt goes away, they get enough money, they get a good relationship, they get their health sorted out, they get a good job, they get some spiritual awareness that gives them clarity and certainty, or religion, and they're social, they get a network of friends. Everything surrounds them saying, you can have certainty of the future because look, it's all packaged up nicely. The doubt is such a habit and such a default for that person that they doubt the friends, they doubt the job, they doubt their money, they doubt they'll have enough, they doubt. And that leads to incredible sabotage, incredible mental health problem. So certainty is organic. It's natural. It's totally natural. It's not an aspiration. We don't aspire to certainty. And the root of certainty, a root of all certainty, the only way to have a guarantee of certainty in your life is your imagination. There is no other certainty. And that's shocking for people to hear, because they think rational, logical, practical capacities will build a world of certainty around them, but it actually doesn't. I've worked with, in my coaching career, I've worked with 3 multi-billionaires who lived in doubt. And when they got certainty of their money, their relationship, or their health, or whatever it was, and doubt made them build their billion-dollar business. Sure, it motivated them to try and get on from it, but they carried the doubt into their life, into the future, because they thought it was a default. They thought it was normal. But what it is, what doubt is a real sign that we're not in our normal. Normal is certainty. Certainty is something that if you were in a room with a good leader, the leader has certainty, but they don't have certainty about how things will get done, why things are going to be done, who's going to do them, when they're going to be finished. They don't have certainty about any of the who, when, what, when, how, why. They don't have. What they have is certainty of an image. And they'll stumble and they'll struggle and they'll wrestle with translating what they see in their imagination into language. So, for example, when I work in First Nation in Canada, they have this terrible thing, which is it's like a collaborative committee, life by committee. So they'll have 10 people in a committee or in a group. They are of mixed appetite for tradition and life and religion, so they're quite a diverse group. And they're also got a diverse group of opinions. And if they have no leader in that group who has an imagination, if they don't have a what they call a pipe carrier or or a medicine person or a chief. That group just goes around and around. They pass the talking stick around and around and around. Nothing ever happens. It just goes around and around. When finally, if they have a leader, which if they're going to achieve anything, they must have. So it's almost always is hierarchical. There's got to be someone. The astonishing thing about the leader is they're of an indigenous group, is always extraordinarily the most patient person you'll ever meet in your life. They listen, so they're present. They're not thinking about what they think, they're thinking about what you think. Present. Now it's your turn, the leader's turn. And they typically look up when they talk. So they see something in the sky, or they see something in their head. They see something, an idea, which is what everyone's working on. And they'll struggle to bring that idea down into words to share with everyone. And so they'll talk really slowly. And it's almost like one word. They might go, bright light. Everyone's sitting there going, oh, I got no idea what that monkey's talking about over there. So they absolutely struggle to translate the thing they can see. And the thing is, the difference between a Western person and an Indigenous leader is that the Indigenous leader will hold the picture fixed in their brain, and that's where their mind and their body and their soul is directed. That's their true nature. And they will hold that while they try to talk. Whereas in the West, we see the picture, we might have a good picture of where we want to go. Then we drop the picture, come down and look at everybody in the room and try to explain it. It's the difference between certainty and clarity, or certainty and motivation, or whatever you want to call it. It's when you have absolutely certainty, you must be looking at the thing in your mind's eye while you talk about it. And in traditions, ancient, in indigenous traditions, the time to allow somebody to do that is available. In the West, if you tried to do that in a meeting, people would go, would you get on with it, please? You know? But that's it. So that's normal. Gratitude, presence, certainty. And if you do all those three things, you'll be walking around saying, I love what I do. I do what I love. The 1,000, falling in love 1,000 times a day. That's automatic. It's not a trick. If you have gratitude, presence, certainty, you'll be falling in love with people, with dogs and cats and grasshoppers, and you'll be falling in love with stuff all the time, because that's just natural mental health. And the way that I determine when I work with a person whether they are in a mentally healthy place is I go to the last one first, to see whether they have love for what's going on around them. And the way I work that out is to see whether they have a sense of humor or not. Because I think I go to love. I want to see whether gratitude, presence, if you have gratitude, presence, certainty, the last one, love, will be there. That's a sign. That's a smoke signal, or whatever you want to call it, that says all the other three are okay. And if you have love, what love really means is, to me, to the detection of it, to experience someone, to ask whether that person has gratitude, presence, certainty, and therefore love, and to work out whether they have love, I just see whether they've got a sense of humor or not. Now, if they've lost their sense of humor, life's become heavy or dark or angry or something like that, I know for sure one of the three is has gone south.
So,
story, mental health is not an aspiration. Anything going wrong with mental health can only be out of three camps. It can be either gratitude for the past, present in the moment, or certainty of the future. There's only one of those three can happen. You can't have all three. If one of those three goes south, if you lose gratitude for the past, if you lose presence in now, if you lose certainty for the future, then you know what to do to fix it, just to come back to being normal. But ungrateful for the past, lack of presence in the present moment, which, you know, it means not turning up present and excited, and lack of certainty, which would mean doubt about the future, those three things can be easily fixed. Let's talk about seeing where the root cause of a lot of our behavior is and blaming somebody in the past for that. If the root cause of our behavior is something we want to change, if the behavior is something we want to change, then we're not happy with ourselves. So we're ungrateful, we're not present, and we're blaming someone for doing something wrong that causes us to be somebody we don't like. Now, what would be the better solution to that, to get to like the someone we are, or blame somebody for doing something wrong that made us the person we are? I mean, seriously, you think about it, that's a complete cock-up. That's awful, because we say, I blame those people, my parents, I blame those people for making really big cock-ups because they made me who I am. And who I am is not who I like. Or you could go back and say, I like who I am, and so there's no cock-up. So I thank the people who brought me up. And the only reason we would be saying, I don't like who I am, is because we're comparing ourselves to someone we're not. And therein lies a mental health problem, trying to be someone else other than who we are. You know, I can, in my own life, I can go back to my alcoholic stepmother and my death of my mother and my father, and I can blame people for me becoming a lying, cheating bastard. Or I can say, I'm really thankful for all that happening, so I become a lying, cheating bastard that I really like. And then all the qualities of lying, cheating bastard, they're all the qualities of a professional speaker. Because, you know, you get up and tell stories, and what you do is you magnify and exemplify and you stratify, and you're telling stories to an audience. Well, really, the whole thing is just trying to convince people to listen to you and engage with you, and that's kind of like marketing 101, you know. And so I can say, yeah, I'm a lying, cheating bastard, but if I wasn't, I wouldn't be a very good speaker. It's not lying, cheating, bastard. I go, okay, I'm a good storyteller. That's the lying part. Cheating means I get up on stage and pretend that I'm super confident and super clever and super inspired, but really deep down I'm shaking in my boots. So the cheating, I'm really cheating everybody that I'm putting on a bit of an act. And bastard, well, you know, I don't know, but... You know, the bottom line is that I can either thank dad and stepmom for all of that, or I can curse them. If I thank them, I just find a good it's more likely that I'll like who I am. If I curse them and try and fix it, it's more likely I'll not like who I am, and I'll enter a realm of perpetual self-development, which is when I I'll like myself, which will never be, because the habit of not liking myself becomes my default. And I'd rather say, look, gratitude for the past. If I have to be grateful for the past, then that means I don't want to change it. And if I'm grateful for the past, that means who I've arrived at, I can't change that either, because otherwise I'll get ungrateful for the past. So I better like who I am, which makes me present with who I am and not want to be different. And I celebrate my idiosyncrasies or my warped sense of humor or my whatever it is as being, I always remember the story by Ram Dass. And he talks, and I've mentioned this before, Ram Dass says he was a professor of psychiatry at Harvard. He was at Berkeley. He was the professor of something else, psychology. He lived in India for years, had a guru, taught meditation, wrote 30 books on spiritual human development. And he is in the ripe old age before he had his stroke. He was right old age of 60-something years old, and he's walking down a street in his old hometown, and one of his old school friends from high school, 45 years since they met each other. 45 years. And Ram Dass is doing all this psychological change, meditation, spiritual things, seances, everything, and psychology and psychiatry and doing experimenting on himself. And he meets this person from high school in the street, and they're talking for 2 minutes, and the guy, his mate, raps him on the shoulder and starts laughing. He says, "Oh, by God, you haven't changed a bit." It's so funny, and it's the truth. I think the secret is, if you got grateful for the past, you can't change it because you're grateful for it. So if you can't change the past, you can't change who you are, because if you're ungrateful for the past, you can change who you are, because you go, if those parents had have done this different, I'd be somebody else. And if I could be somebody else, I'll go and work on that. But you can't. You can't be somebody else. You weren't meant to be somebody else. You're meant to be you. There's only one you on the whole planet. So you're better to go, I'm grateful for whatever went on, because it made me this, you know, as I said before, lying, cheating bastard, or whatever you want to say about yourself. And you go, and that makes me a great professional speaker. Makes me really entertaining on stage, or it makes me really clever at helping people through trauma, that, like working with First Nation and as I did in Canada. There's no way I can be straight. I had to tell story and weave a story that was true but false in order to engage. So in one way, I all the work to change myself by judging myself, by wishing things didn't happen in the past, had to turn around and go, I'm glad they happened, and I don't want to change myself. This is what I've arrived at. And that means I'm grateful for the past, and that's step one of being normal. That's not an aspiration. That's not like we're not trying to become, you know, spiritual gurus here. What we're saying is, I just want to be freaking me. I just want to be normal me with no mental health problem. So I just want to be default normal. And default normal, number one, is gratitude for whatever's happened in my life, finding a function for it, and not regretting or resenting or wishing anybody who's been part of that trip anything. So it's a matter of just telling story to say, I'm perfect as I am. I'm worthy of, no matter what I've done or not done, I'm worthy of love. And the bottom line is, you get condemned and people go, oh, you're a bastard. And I go, I know. You're a liar, Chris Walker. I go, I know. I'm really good at it. I learned that from the circumstances of my life. I don't want to change that. That makes me a good storyteller, gives me a good speaker, on stage. It also helps me Because when the chips are down and I feel like a piece of shit sometimes, you know, in my life, I've not made that public. So I've cheated everybody. I've gone, hey, everyone, you know, 30 years ago, man, my chips were down. I lost everything in the world and my chips were down, but nobody knew. That's my lying, cheating bastard actually functional. I don't want to get rid of that. I don't want to blame my stepmom or my dad, my alcoholic, violent stepmom, who I could tell a story about that makes her sound like a witch, or I could say, thank God for this woman. Thank God for her strength and her tenacity, and she drilled it and drilled it and taught me to be intuitive and taught me to know when a punch is coming and taught me to know how to tell her what she wanted to hear so I didn't get beaten up. I go, thank goodness this little bit of storytelling started then. So I don't want to change it. I want to celebrate it. But that doesn't make me special. That makes me normal. Because there are some people who don't have violent alcoholic stepmoms and dead mums and shit like that. And they don't have to deal with all this sort of question because they got a smooth track and they're already grateful for the past. I meet them. People who got a great smooth run right to today. There's nothing to regret. They don't even look at the past with any sense of, and they're not bigger than me. They're just normal. Every religion on earth, every single religion on earth, every single philosophy, all the self-help, everything is designed to alleviate doubt. Because there's nothing wrecks us more than doubt. And the doubt comes from fear, fear of the future. And all religion is built out of fear of the future and trying to reconcile that to alleviate doubt. It just doesn't do a good job of it. Because the only certainty religion can give you is what's going to happen after you die. But every religious person knows that. It doesn't give you certainty whether you're going to have a job tomorrow. It doesn't give you certainty whether a bomb's going to blow up under your feet. It doesn't give you certainty whether your partner's going to have an affair. It does. Any religious person really, really knows that the only certainty they get from their religion is, in some sense, what's going to happen when they don't know what's going to happen and no one can prove it to be wrong. You know, the Buddha say you'll be reincarnated. Another one will say you go to heaven, but nobody can prove it to be wrong. So the religion wins when it's the long haul, but it can't give you any certainty over the short term. I'm climbing a mountain. Am I going to fall? Am I not going to fall? Well, the religion might tell you won't, but if you do, well, that's because your fault, not the religion. You know, it's like, so I think overcoming that doubt of the future, which is confronting our fears, which is dealing with our fears and getting certainty, the only place it can come from is our imagination. And we have to be careful because there's a difference between fantasy and imagination. Fantasy is pleasure driven. Imagination is being absolutely present with an image of the future that you have no emotional connection to. And that's why it's hard to describe. It's not like, oh, there I am dancing with 40 naked people, making love and rolling down a hill and then swimming in the ocean and basking in sunlight, eating grapes and drinking wine. That's all pleasure driven. That's a fantasy. An imagination is, I'm on a cliff top overlooking a valley. There's stillness, there's tranquility, and there's a soft white cloud of love that's radiating into the hearts of all the people in the valley who are sick. That's an imagination. That's what leaders have, big leaders, imaginations that they struggle to translate, but not fantasies. And fantasies are lopsided emotional perceptions. So doubt's tricky because you can trick yourself in overcoming doubt by having a fantasy. Oh, I see myself on stage with 1,000 people singing hallelujah in a chorus when you haven't sung and you've got and you're tone deaf and you someone might say it's giving you a picture of the future and giving you a way to get into the future, but it's got a fantasy built into it because there's a pleasure. And that's where the road forks in dealing with doubt. And a lot of mental health problems come from exactly this point. A lot of people, the default is every single child gets born on this planet with an imagination. And then the parents start teaching them how to add up 1 and 1 makes 2. What color is it? Why are you doing that? They start to train them and educate them in a brain, and their brain becomes more and more rational, and they read books instead of creating them, and they watch TV instead of making a movie, right? And so it's very easy to relax and let and even go to church and let the Bible tell you stories instead of you telling stories. So it's very easy to let the world give you the stories rather than you learn the skill. So this imagination thing is very organic. It's very natural. Every human being, and it's not an aspiration. It's mental health. It's normal. The lack of it is a problem. And we can fix that problem by practicing and practicing imagination. So I say to every parent's got a couple of kids, I say, you're born with the greatest gift on earth. You're born with a couple of educators who are going to teach you how to use your imagination. Because when you tell them a story, not read it, when you tell them a story, if they get bored and they fall asleep halfway through it, you've got a bit of homework to do on your storytelling. Your imagination has become your intellect. Because if you're really imagining something and you can see it in your mind's eye, they're there. That's leadership. That's overcoming doubt. That's normal. That's certainty.